Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 million suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots, global, unembedded, international, independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
Hello, my name is Josh. This is Textbook on CITR 101.9 FM. We are broadcasting live from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Coast Salish people. Today, the Back to School episode, we start off with an interview with Eli Teed, who is a student here at UBC. He's a musician. We start off with an interview with Lena Castro that I did earlier today. Lena Castro is heading up AMS Vice, which is a really cool service here at the university that provides support to, people that are concerned about their usage, alcohol, drugs, and technology usage, but wouldn't maybe consider themselves full-on, addicted or something like that. It's a really great new support service. Then we go into an interview with Eli Teed. He is a student here at UBC. He's also a musician. He plays in the band Jericho. And he's talking a little bit about his music education. And then an interview with Sonia, who will be here talking about some academic stuff. So I'm going to kick it off right now with an interview with Lena Castro. She works with the AMS, and it was a really great interview. I also want to mention, as I do at the end of this interview, that the first AMS Vice dialogue session is happening on Thursday. I give some details about that at the end. Thanks for listening.
So what is Vice? No, not this Vice. This Vice. Vice is a brand new AMS service to help students find their balance with alcohol, drugs, and technology use. Okay, so how are we doing that? We're focusing on three areas to help you find your balance. One, education. Two, dialogue. And three, mentoring.
That was the intro video for AMS Vice, which is a new AMS program that supports addiction, counseling, and the like. I'm here with Lena Castro, who is the head of that program here at UBC. She's also a UBC student. Lena, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm great.
So tell me a little bit about how you got involved with this program in the first place.
Okay, so my background at UBC has been with mental health, and I've been working in that for the last few years, but my work with that has been very policy-based. I'm on Senate, and I worked for the VP Academic Office at the AMS. It's all been pretty, not boring, but the changes that we make through that avenue are pretty high level, and some of the things that I've been pushing with that is like the first term reading break, a syllabus policy, things like this that I think are very important, but the actual change wouldn't be seen for a long time. And so one of the reasons that I got involved with Vice particularly and made the switch into the services is that you get to see directly the kind of impact that you have on students. And particularly with Vice as a brand new service, I thought that that would be a really cool way to build something and really leave my mark here in a way that is unique. And I don't think that opportunity would have come in a lot of different ways. So
what is the kind of development of Vice look like? You got hired to do this in the summer, in the beginning of September. When was it?
Yeah, so I got hired in the summer, and at that point they had just approved this idea of the service. And so I came in and they said, okay, we're trying to develop something for alcohol, drugs, technology, go for it. And I was pretty intimidated by the whole thing. And so that development through the summer, what I did was basically I tried to find out what the gap on campus was and what the service could do realistically, considering that we are all just student volunteers, and so none of us are professionals. So thinking that we are about to tackle addiction was not very realistic. And so I spoke with student health services, counseling services, access and diversity, and a lot of different people on campus that may have experienced interactions with students about these kinds of topics before. And then I researched into what exists in Vancouver as well through Vancouver Coastal Health or other third-party organizations. And I basically just tried to think, I don't want to duplicate anything that already exists and people are already doing well, because that would be a waste of our time. But what could students actually benefit from that isn't already out there? And so that gap that I thought we could really fill was the peer part and having a friend walk you through these steps that seem very intimidating. So for a student who's thinking, maybe I have a problem, taking that first step of even just admitting to yourself that you're trying to make a change in your life can be very intimidating. And then at that point when you think, okay, let's say I have a problem and I need to do something about it, what do I do? Like, going to a service or going to someone really makes it clear that, you know, okay, I actually have a problem, like I'm actually doing something about it. And that can be very scary. So the service is supposed to be a friend or just someone who is telling you what's out there, what are the possible routes that you can go, what are some skills that you can build on yourself without even having to go to a professional quite yet. So maybe you just think, oh, I have a little bit of an issue with this, but I don't want to say I'm addicted, because that's such a big stigmatized word. What are some, you know, take-home skills that I can just use to help myself and find my balance?
So this is kind of a service that's directed at people that maybe don't have, are kind of in this middle ground where this is maybe starting to be an issue, but it's not big enough to kind of make a whole thing out of it. What else kind of separates Vice from other programs?
So one big thing that we were trying to develop with the message of Vice is that, again, we're a peer, we're just a friend, we're just like your buddy that you're talking to. So we're not trying to be abstinence-based like a lot of other programs. We're not trying to say, don't do this, don't do that. We're not your mom telling you what to do. We are really just a service that is telling you what are all your options. And so that's a big reason why we went with the slogan, find your balance. And so we're telling you, you know, you're an adult, do what you want to be doing, but do it in the best way that you're happy with. And that's why it's about finding your balance and not stopping anything that you're doing.
So describe for me a little bit what it would look like if you were to go and go to Vice and you know, start taking up their services. What would that kind of look like?
Sure. So in the clip that you played, they kind of went over the three things that we do. So it's education, dialogue, and mentoring. So education is just through campaigns, but if you were actually to come to Vice as a service, the two service things that we do are dialogue and mentoring. So we have weekly dialogue sessions, and these would either be focused around drugs or alcohol or technology. So if you come in, we'd kind of already know the topic, the general topic of the conversation. And in that conversation, we would just talk about, what does this use look like for you? You know, what are some issues you've had? How have you overcome these? What are some tools that you've used? And so hopefully students can pick up from other tools that other students have used and see, you know, these are issues that everyone is kind of struggling with, and how can we all take a step back and find our balance? And then the other thing, the mentoring, is if you think, okay, maybe I tried a dialogue session, or maybe I've tried a couple of these tools before and I just am really not at a place where I'm happy with either alcohol or drug or technology use in my life, or a mixture of those. So we'd link you up with a mentor who is a student volunteer. And this is someone who may or may not have gone through a similar struggle. And these students would sit you down and talk about, okay, where are you at right now and where are you trying to go? And together you'd map out this kind of journey of getting to a place where you're really happy with the alcohol or drug or technology use in your life. And so through that, you could actually make use of all the things that exist on campus and off campus. And so one of the things I was saying that's really intimidating, if you Google like what exists, it's overwhelming. It's just you think, okay, I don't know where to start. I don't know what to do. And so these volunteers are trained in all these things that exist and would help you figure out which of these services that exist could be best for you, and then help you to actually go to that. And, you know, making that first appointment even can be very scary. So they'd help you go to that first appointment, ask you how it went, ask you what you got out of it and the next step, and just kind of be with you for that whole journey of getting better.
Mm-hmm. So drugs and alcohol, I think a lot of people, you know, that makes sense, that there's services for that. Technology services, I think that's a little bit different too. Like, can you maybe outline your idea of what I mean, or I guess it was the AMS that came to you with this, outline that problem for people a little bit.
Sure. So, like we were saying before, this service isn't necessarily for someone who says, I have an addiction. It's just someone who says, there's a problem in my life, there's something that I'm not finding a balance with. And so we can often see that with either our social media use or our online gaming use, or even, it's become actually pretty relevant with the eSports Society on campus. Somebody from that association was talking to me about these kinds of things, that sometimes you just get so into all these technology things that exist in our lives, which are awesome, but they can kind of take over your life, and you think all of a sudden, you know, I don't have a balance in this. And so that is just one of the topics that you could come talk to us about how do you realign and really find a use that you're happy with.
What have been some of the challenges that you've faced in developing the program and bringing in, training the volunteers and that whole process?
So luckily I got a pretty good connection with the Wellness Center, and Amanda, who runs that, has been able to provide a lot of help with training, but finding out what that training was going to look like was pretty tough because there aren't really any other services that exist like this. Mainly a lot of the programs that exist out there, not all, but many are abstinence-based, like I was saying, or provide just very big ideas that might be very intimidating for a student, for you to come in and say, okay, this is how we're going to deal with your addiction. Or like a lot of the, for example, our dialogue sessions, those are kind of mirrored after like a peer therapy group. But again, this isn't a therapy group in the sense that you're not coming in and you're not saying, these are the problems that I have. You know, my name is Lena, like I am an addict. Like mm-hmm. That's kind of idea that exists already about AA or NA. So to reframe that and think anybody can come in, like this is very low barrier. Somebody who's not saying, I have a problem, because that we were saying, like that's such a tough thing to admit. So just dialogue, we're just talking, but still using some of those therapeutic skills and still using some of those motivational interviewing skills, for example, that exist in these therapy groups.
Have you gotten any kind of like, I don't know, pushback or flack from maybe other groups on campus or for people that are thinking that this might not be a good idea or a good strategy?
So definitely within the AMS, maybe I actually felt like there was some, not second thoughts, but when I was hired, for example, they told me if at the end of your, because I was hired to develop the service, and they said, if at the end of this process, you think this is just not going to be a realistic thing, we just can't do it, that's fine. That's what you're hired to do. And so I think that they were ready at least to maybe not have a service at all. But through my conversations with anyone on campus, actually, from student health services to counseling to anything like that, the response was so overwhelmingly positive that it actually helped me a lot in those first steps and reinforced that this is something that we need on campus.
Cool. Tell me a little bit about the strategies and tricks or maybe advice that you can give that Vice is seeking to employ.
Sure. So one of the big ones that I found really helpful actually was this idea of framing don't into do. And so a lot of the time when we have a behavior that we don't want to do, we think I need to stop doing this or don't do this. So an example is like, maybe I go out on Friday nights too much. And so I'm sitting there on Friday night and I'm telling myself, don't go out, don't go out, don't pick up the phone, don't text my friend, you know, don't go grab a beer. But this kind of gives you in this negative loop. And so reframing this into a do. So, okay, I'm not going to do that. What am I going to do instead? So, for example, go to a movie. Do go to a movie. You know, do go out bowling. Right? You know, something that is replacing the activity that you're not wanting to do anymore. And so this can be a lot easier when you're trying to digest making change. So instead of thinking, oh, I suck because I'm, you know, don't do this. Oh, it's just very negative. Instead, you're thinking, okay, this is what I'm going to do. This is a step that I can take.
Cool. Lena, thank you so much for coming and joining me this afternoon and talking about this and taking the time.
Yeah, no worries. Thank you for having me.
Textbook will be back after a quick PSA.
Most days, my partner and I pass through the world unnoticed. He's a he, I'm a she, and that makes us invisible. Except the time we crossed the border into the U.S. My partner wasn't a citizen of either country, so we had to park our car and request special permission to enter. At that time, his passport didn't indicate that he was male. So, as he had done many times before, He calmly explained why. The guard showed no expression. She simply nodded and left the counter with his passport, disappearing into a small office. While she was in there, five different guards slowly walked out of that office, each one trying but failing to appear nonchalant, and looked at my partner. Or I should say, looked over my partner. I was fuming. I wanted to call them out on it, but if I did, I would have ruined our chances of spending the weekend in Portland. Eventually, we were given permission to enter. Without a word, we walked back to our car and continued on our journey. I can't believe what just happened, I raged. My partner grinned and shrugged his shoulders. At the time, I was writing an article about how being queer was not just about being in a state of oppression. Some of us experience a certain pleasure in being a freak, and I called that experience freaking. Why aren't you mad? I demanded. It's just like freaking, he said. While I was raging at the customs counter, my partner was quietly enjoying messing with the border guards' heads.
Hey, this is Josh Ciatier, 101.9 FM. You're listening to Textbook. We are broadcasting live from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Coast Salish people. You just heard Palita Nohai. That is a Montreal / Berlin group. Really, really good stuff. They have a new EP out. Next up is an interview I did earlier this week with Eli Teed. Eli's a political science student here, and he's also a musician in the band Jericho. They're very good. You should check them out. Hope you enjoy. Hey, I'm here with Eli Teed. He is a Discorder contributor. He's also in the band Jericho and the band Mutual. He goes to school here at UBC and just sitting down for an interview, talking about some stories and stuff. Eli, how you doing?
I'm doing well. It's good to be back in school. It's bittersweet to be back in school.
Yeah, it's it is bittersweet.
Yeah.
Tell me about the music projects you're involved in. The first one is Jericho, and Jericho, you guys have a show tonight, actually.
We have a show tonight. We have a show on the day of this recording.
Which is Friday.
Which is Friday. yeah, the Trash City 2-year anniversary at the Biltmore, and the upstairs, the ballroom side of the Biltmore. I'm sure something else is going on. The cabaret itself, but that'll be really good. We've had kind of a long time relationship with Maddie, who does Trash City, and so we're there celebrating that.
What kind of music is it?
Jericho is something of a throwback. It is fairly psychedelic and kind of an old way of thinking of psych rock. It's kind of anchored by a lot of bass. Pasang, who plays bass in the band, also sings in the band, is often at the forefront. And then also the cello is a really big part of it as well. One of the few bands, I think, out in the city that has a cello as like at its forefront.
Great.
For sure. Which kind of gives it those kind of long, kind of weird and winding tones. So yeah, it's good. Some of the songs get really long and kind of really out there. Some of them are a lot more straightforward, but we all come from kind of different musical backgrounds and different levels of like music education and you know, interests in different types of music. So a lot of that kind of gets bled into how the sound is.
And you drum in that band. What's your music education like?
My music education, I've been playing drums since I was 10. So for the majority of my life now, I have been playing drums. Did a lot of jazz drumming when I went through high school, and a lot of my chops come from that, and I still kind of bring a lot of that with me. I also played a lot of other percussive instruments. I don't really anymore, but when you're in high school and that's what's offered to you, you end up playing a lot of like timpani and like marimba and all these other wacky things, but it was really great. Like, it was a fun thing to get to
do.
So
what was your reason for choosing to do music in the first place? I mean, I guess drums specifically? Why?
Drums specifically, I mean, I wanted to translate it. Like, drums for me, it was interesting. When I was growing up, like my parents, my dad specifically, was always a big music guy. He doesn't play any instruments. His argument was always that someone has to listen, and that was him. He couldn't play, but someone had to listen. And so music was always around. Like, when I was, you know, adolescent, infantile, there, you know, you'd have Raffi on for a couple songs, and then you'd have like Tom Waits on for a couple songs. So it was always around. It was always kind of a big presence. And so my deciding to take up an instrument was kind of bound to be. I thought about doing guitar for a little bit, as everyone does, but then I decided that like everyone plays guitar. I don't want to play guitar. And my favorite band at the time, and in large ways still, was the White Stripes. And when you only have guitar and drums, your only other option, if you're not gonna play guitar, is to play drums. And I was like, I can do that, especially when you're listening to Meg White, who I love very dearly. But I was like, I can play those things. So yeah, that was for me. And I was never an overwhelmingly sporty youth. So drums and music was definitely a big outlet, and I know that's the case for a lot of people, but it was certainly for me as well.
You grew up in Vancouver, North Vancouver.
I did. I'm pretty much Vancouver born and raised. Yeah, I spent a lot of time in North Vancouver. A good chunk of my mom's side of the family's out that way. But yeah, I was like, my youngest years were in East Van. I lived on like East 4th and Main Street kind of area in a loft. And I'm also an only child, so I've got all sorts of bad things going for me.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, my parents and I bounced around a lot within the city and trying to kind of find the right place to settle. So I lived there, and then I lived right on Richard Street, like across from Richards on Richards, which was a nightclub. That was an establishment for sure, and got shut down X amount of years ago now. But it was quite an interesting place to live across the street from, because it was like right in the heart of downtown. And that was when I was like 9 or 10 years old. And then, yeah, we eventually moved out to North Vancouver because I was going to school there. A lot of my mom's side of the family was there. And then have now worked our way back to East Van.
Cool.
Yeah.
Going back to band, were you guys, I mean, the other like
stereotype of band is like some kind of crazy trips or like retreats. Did you do any of those?
All the time. Every year. That was one of the big things, actually, I think, is that I think one of the reasons so many kids signed up for the music program, one was because, you know, it was rewarding in its own right. But another was like, I just want to go on trips. Mm-hmm. Like, that sounds great. And it was. Yeah, we did a bunch. We did like a semi-annual trip to Banff, Alberta, which was always really, really nice. But the two big ones for me, when I was in the 10th grade, I went to New York. And then my last year of high school, I went to China. And those were like two pretty intense trips for sure.
Tell me about the New York one first. What was it like?
The New York one was interesting because I wasn't really playing drums for that trip. I was playing with the choir. I was singing in the choir. It was the only year I ever sang in the choir because the entire time, you know, I was in high school, I was doing something with the choirs. I was never much of a singer, but so I'd usually do either hand percussion or I'd sit behind a kit for some songs. So the choir instructor was like, we want you to come on this trip, but it kind of doesn't make sense to like bring you all the way to New York to like play djembe on like a couple of these songs. Right. And I was like, okay, that's fair. So I joined choir for that 1 year kind of to go on the trip. And that was great. Like, I haven't been back to New York since then. It was quite an experience to go with like a bunch of like 16-year-olds.
Yeah.
Like, it's always kind of, it's an interesting time to like be in a city like that. And definitely tried to make the most of it. Definitely had some mishaps. And you know, when you're a goof and you have a bunch of goofy friends and you're trying to like make your way around the city, you don't always know what you're doing. I think the first night we got there, my really good friend and I, we were given like 15 minutes in Times Square alone. It was like, we just finished dinner. Like, I think our principal was on us with the trip and then like some chaperones and then the music teachers and stuff. And they're like, okay, tell you what, like stay in a couple block radius. You've got like X amount of time, really short amount of time. Like go
souvenirs,
check
souvenirs. Just get
like
souvenirs.
Yeah. Like go to like a corner store, just come back. Like, you know, we're just going to let you out loose for like a second and then we're going to go do something else. And my friend and I took that opportunity thinking that we had plenty of time to go down what ended up being like over 20 blocks, I think. And these are Times Square blocks, so like it's busy, they're big, and so forth, to try to get to Midtown Comics, because we were both big nerds and like had heard about Midtown Comics for so long, which is like this huge store in New York. So we hoofed it and realized, I think like halfway, we're like, we won't make it in time. Like, there's no chance. But we're like, but we've made it this far. Like, it was that point of no return where you're like, you know you've screwed up, but goddamn, like it's close enough that you kind of have to. Now, if you turn around, you're coming back with nothing. So we just went for it. And I think, I don't know how late we were, but when you're that age and like people are responsible for you, any time is too late, right? And so we came back and just got reamed out for it. And that was bad. But they were like, you know what? Just like, don't be stupid. Don't anything again. It's
fine.
Did
you come back with comics too?
I'm pretty sure we came. There was like, you couldn't hide it, right? You were like, yeah, we.
The fruits.
The fruits of our labor. Yeah, it was brutal. But they were like, okay, don't be dumb for the rest of the trip. And we're like, easy, no problem. But then that we performed at Carnegie Hall, which was a crazy experience.
Yeah, that's nuts. That's actually huge.
That was a wild experience for sure in and of itself. And this big, like, massive chamber choir, too, with, like, there was other schools involved and stuff as well, and, like, other professional choral singers and other just apparatus that was, pretty intense. So they essentially, like, a sold-out show in Carnegie Hall, which is something in and of itself. But the day of that, you know, the whole impetus for the trip, me and the same friend and a couple of the people who were all staying in the same room in the hotel, our alarm didn't go off. The one day out of, like, the 5 days that we really needed the alarm to go off and that we thought we had set it, it didn't go off. So, well, I think we got like a buzz from like the concierge desk or someone, and they're like kind of like, "Where are you guys?" Like everyone in the rest of the choir is like downstairs waiting. Like you're supposed to be here already, and we were just like, "Oh my god!" So we were all freaking out because we're 16 and don't even like know how to tie our shoes properly at this point. So we try to get our collective shit together and like run down to the lobby. Like none of us had showered.
What are you like? What was the attire?
It was like
for this?
full head to toe, like black, like dress clothes. Yeah, and we had like a vest as well that was like very gaudy and like horrid. So we're like running down like that, and like just terrible. Like my hair was a mess and everything else. And like none of us have eaten, and we're all starving. And so, kind of clandestinely, I tried to like, kind of like slip out and just try to go like get a bite to eat. Like I think I told like one of the chaperones like I'll be right back. Like I just like and they're like, hey, like go but come back, like we have to leave. And so the nearest place to really get food was Grand Central Station, like just by proximity to like where our hotel was. So I was running around Grand Central Station and looking like I don't know, some sort of like I'm not even sure, like Bosnian like street performer. I have no idea, the weirdest getup on. Yeah, and like just trying, like I had no idea like really where I was or what I was doing, just trying to get like a croissant and some orange juice. And I did, thankfully, with no time to spare, and was looked down upon thereafter. So that was the New York trip,
I remember having like a very similar trip when I was like, I guess in grade 11, so like 17. Yeah. And sleeping in a hotel room with three other people, like two beds, sleeping somebody else and sharing a bed with them. And the person I was sharing a bed with was like sleep talked like the whole night. And it was like really like, weird, like terrifying stuff, like really some like, you know, the unconscious really bubbling up.
For sure,
and
some exorcism stuff.
He was talking about his dad. It was like, it was really intense.
Yeah.
And like those trips are, those trips are weird.
They definitely shape you. I had a lot of them through music, and also I was for a couple years in high school, I was on the rowing team, so we'd go to regattas.
Okay.
And it wasn't usually like my closest friends. Like I had one really good friend in rowing, and him and I just kind of screwed around and both quit fairly early on because we were like, we're not cut out for this. No one's cut out for it. It's a crazy sport. But yeah, some of the regattas we went to, there was that. There was one night in particular where we were staying with this one guy on the team who we really didn't like. And it ended up being a literal salami fight in our room, as in like the guy had like a packet of salami and like threw it at my really close friend, and it kind of just went downhill from there. Like it was
the salami.
There was a legitimate salami exchange. You really shouldn't put four teenage boys in a room unsupervised together for any reason.
It's such like a really ludicrous like prospect even at the most basic level.
Yeah.
What about the China trip? Tell me about that.
The China trip was really cool. The China trip was Nothing went too awry in that trip, luckily. But it was the first like transcontinental journey I'd ever really done. I had traveled before, but I hadn't like left North America by that point, and have since. But that was a really big deal for me because I'd been itching to kind of go, and this was a really great opportunity to go. So it was kind of something of a cultural exchange trip. So we would go and perform, and then we'd have to see other performances by like local Chinese schools and stuff. And this was a band trip, so I wasn't singing or anything. This was like me behind some sort of percussion apparatus. So that was a big deal too. The biggest thing was we actually got to play a set or play our kind of concert on the Great Wall of China, which when advertised seems like the coolest idea.
Yeah,
but then you actually, and it was, but then you also get to the Great Wall of China and realize like there's a reason no one plays shows on the Great Wall of China, because it is in no way equipped to handle such a thing. Like there was a stage.
Yeah.
There was also heavy wind. And, like, it was, oh, my God. So you have, you know, a bunch of 16 to 17-year-old kids and their instruments. And, like, we're lugging up, like, literally lugging, like, timpanis and, like, vibraphones and all this other just, you know, whatever, up steps and stuff. There's no elevator. It's the Great Wall of China. So, like, you have to just lift these things around. And they got us to a certain point on the wall because it's huge. It's insanely big. Where it wasn't too much of a hassle, but, like, you're still, like, literally, there's a whole bunch of tourists, there's a whole bunch of locals, and you're trying to, like, push through equipment like this and a whole bunch of chairs and stuff. So we eventually get set up. Immediately realize that the wind is going to pose a problem because you have sheet music and there's wind, and those two things do not get along very well. So you're trying to, like, weigh things down as much as you can or hold on to something or whatever. And so everything eventually kind of gets sorted. We make the best of it. We play our set. And it was crazy, like, just to be there to be doing that. And,
yeah.
Like, it was enriching in and of itself, I suppose. But it was weird. Like, it was very much like a window dressing performance. Like, there was no real audience necessarily.
Yeah.
Like, there were people who were, like, happened to be on the Great Wall at that
the
spot.
Tourists.
Who, like,
took
some photos and were like, that was cool. And it was cool for us, but we were kind of like, this is such, like, a strange experience.
Yeah.
And it really was. And the other kind of additional factor that made it strange was that my uncle was there. And he's my dad's brother, and my dad's to the family I don't know as well as my mother's, just in terms of proximity.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my mom's side of the family emigrated from Africa to here, whereas most of my dad's side of the family is still in Calgary. And this uncle, Chris, left Calgary and moved to China when I was, like, really, really, really young. And I, like, haven't really heard from him much or anything. But because I was going to be in Beijing, where he lives, like, with his wife, it was kind of an obvious thing to be like, well, you should, like, meet your uncle. And so that was arranged, and I had met him a couple days before. But it was just such a weird experience to be, like, to be on the Great Wall with, like, three giant timpanis in front of me and my music blowing in the wind and tourists who were indifferent taking photos and, like, my uncle and his wife just off to the side. Like, it was one of those surreal experiences where you're like, I couldn't have written this
if I
wanted
to. Yeah, that is super weird. Yeah. So this is, like, an uncle you don't really know that well.
No, like, I know him better now.
Yeah.
And he's since kind of split his time between him and Dai, his wife, between Canada and China a lot more. But yeah, at the time, for sure, like, it was only really until after that trip that I started to see a little more of him, and he does come and visit and stuff now.
Yeah.
But it had been, whatever, like, 18 years. Like, I was an infant the last time I had seen him or really heard or anything. So that was a really interesting kind of wrench to throw into the mix of, like, A, you're, like, with, you know, your high school in a foreign country, but B, like, I got to, like, kind of spend a day away from everyone and go and, like, have a day with Chris and Diana and, like, do things with them. Like, we went to, like, a Chinese knockoff market, which is a crazy place to
cool,
go to.
Yeah.
Like, just any brand you could imagine. And, like, there's, like, three floors of, like, stalls and everything. But none of it's legit. Like, it's all fake. Like, it looks pretty accurate.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, like, it's 100%, like, not real. Yeah, lots of weird China stories. Lots of market stories, too.
Mm-hmm.
Just, like, just a very strange place. Like, strange to me, at least. To walk into somewhere. A lot of times you just walk into a building expecting something, and something totally different is there.
Hmm.
The kind of teacher's assistant who was on with us on that trip, who helped direct some of the choirs, there was one night where, again, we kind of had some free time, and he was a really young guy, really great guy, and he was like, you know what, I'll take some of you out, we'll do like a little like kind of walking tour impromptu, whoever wants to come can come, so a dozen of us go with him. And we had seen an arcade like a day or so before nearby, and me and the same like friends who were like wanted to go to like the comic shop were like, let's go to the arcade because that's sweet. And so we did. And so we went on this kind of like long kind of tour, like through this like fish market we definitely should not have been at, and like all these other things. Yeah. And then eventually went up this arcade, and we open up the door to it. It's like nighttime by this point. And we are greeted with this room. It was cinematic, honestly. Like, it was this room that was just like covered in smoke, like cigarette smoke. And almost in unison, a bunch of like older Chinese men like turned their heads to us, and they were all around like slot machines essentially.
Yeah.
Like, it was not like an arcade, like it was like an illegal gambling racket at most.
Okay.
And just like stared at us. And so it's like a whole bunch of like Western teenagers and their like chaperone, and we were like, we need to leave like right now.
That's bizarre.
Oh, it was so surreal.
Yeah.
So that was pretty hilarious. Like, we like left in a hurry.
Yeah.
And like burst out laughing afterwards. But it was like that image of like opening that door and just seeing all these
everybody
like
just
aged like cigarette smoking like Chinese men turn around and stare at us like, what are you doing?
I think there's something nice about that, like the kind of like how surreal that is. And I think that the experience of like reconnecting with a family member, or like even just like family members, meeting family members that you don't really have any connection with, but they're family, and
for
like
sure,
this weird sort of like familiarity and also like a complete like lack of familiarity, that's like a really weird thing to negotiate.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, it is a strange thing. And it's interesting to me too that like that experience would not have happened without like the music program at my school, like without me having like taken up drums. Like, it's a long, you know, history and like path to walk if you want to take it, but like, had I not played drums and had not done this and this and that, I would, there's no way I would have gone to China.
Yeah, there's all this contingency,
right? Yeah, like it's hugely contingent on so many things.
Yeah.
But I think experiences like that are so unique to being in programs like that. Like, again, you just, those opportunities are few and far between, I think, especially at that age, for sure.
What about your mom's side of the family?
My mom's side of the family, who's largely here, I've had similar experiences with, like, meeting them in the UK, because it's kind of split between, there's a good portion here and a good portion out in England. But my mom and her brother and sister and her parents, my grandparents, were all born in Uganda. They're all Indian, East Indian in terms of heritage. But there was a large group of Indians that kind of drove the economy in Uganda for a long time and kind of were settlers there, so to speak, I guess. But in the 70s, were driven out by Idi Amin Dada, who came to power in Uganda. It was essentially like, if you were not from here, if you were ethnically, you know, not, you know, part of the general homogeneity of Uganda, you have to go or face dire consequences. Mm-hmm. And so they left. They, you know, were refugees of a sort, I guess, economic refugees, perhaps. And wound up in a bunch of different kind of spots. My grandfather's business at the time was hotels, essentially. He would, like, manage hotels. So my mom, growing up, would, like, live in hotels for different periods of time. She had, like, he had one in, like, Dallas for a bit, and one like in London for a period of time. So she kind of, you know, flitted and fettered around different spots for a period of time. But they eventually kind of wound up in Vancouver and have settled, and they've been retired for a long time and so forth. But yeah, my mom said the family did a lot to like raise me, and I still see them all the time. And it's interesting, like having that side of things for sure, because that's, they are not like super traditionalist Indian grandparents and like Indian family members, but they still are. And like having that kind of growing up with like that half of things and the other half of things always been like pretty interesting and definitely like a part of my identity for sure. But yeah, like I remember talking when I was like young, like in elementary school, to kids about, they're like, oh yeah, like I gotta go to my grandparents for like dinner and like blah blah, blah, and like I don't want to eat meatloaf, and I was like, yeah, cool. And me, like I'd be going and eating like tandoori chicken and like fish curries and like kukupaka and stuff and like all these other like totally foreign things, which like upped my tolerance to spice and to just and to like variance in culture like simultaneously.
So
that was always really interesting.
Do you feel as you get older that you're starting to kind of like, I don't know, your relationship to that heritage or to that tradition is changing, or like do you feel you're taking up more, like I know for a lot of kids it's kind of hard like to associate with it. I don't know, how do you feel that it's been changing?
I mean, I've always really been appreciative of it in a lot of ways for a variety of reasons. I don't think I've made the most of it nearly as much as I could have. Like my grandmother speaks a host of languages, different forms of like Gujarat and other kind of like local tongues that were, you know, in Africa at the time. And even though I spent a lot of time over there, like growing up, like after school, like it was never really like taught to me. There was never like an impetus to do that, which is too bad because I would love to be able to have that language. At the time, I'm sure I would have totally protested. Like, I don't want to learn anything. But, you know, in hindsight. So I think that language barrier has always been something kind of present to me, and I lament a little bit now. But I've always been very appreciative of having it because it's a really cool thing. And again, more exposure to a culture that I otherwise probably wouldn't know as well. And it helps to put things into perspective. Like it's interesting being of that kind of half, you know, minority, half not, like having a white, you know, paternal side and a colored maternal side. Like that's always been a really interesting dynamic. And I've definitely taken that, especially, you know, post-secondary and stuff too, when you study a lot of those things a lot more closely. And through political science and other things that I study, where you see kind of those dynamics and how, you know, over the course of time, those different things have shaped. And so, yeah, I internalize a lot of that while at the same time knowing that I'm definitely apart from it. Like, I haven't suffered in any way because of those things. So,
and what's your relationship like with your grandma? Is she still around?
Yeah. Both all of my grandparents are still around on both sides. Lucky me, which is rad. It's good. Like, our relationship has gotten to the point now. She's gotten older. She's 81. And she loves her iPad very, very dearly. Yeah. There's no one on this earth have I met that loves Candy Crush more than my dear Roshan. And our relationship has evolved or devolved perhaps now to the point where, like, the first thing she does after seeing me and, like, you know, talking to me in kind of broken English, which she has mastered, is like, can you fix my iPad?
Right.
And fixing her iPad is usually just turning it off and on, but because she can't quite figure out how to do that quite yet. I've showed her 14 or so times.
Yeah.
It's okay. Like, I know at this point I've made my peace with it, and I think she's made hers.
Yeah.
So that's a big thing. She loves Candy Crush, and she's a great cook. My grandfather, Sadru, is like an expert bridge player in his old age. He took up bridge like about a decade or so ago. And is like, as far as I can tell, like a master of it now.
That's sweet.
And a big golfer as well. He still golfs at like 80, whatever. The two of them kill a lot of time playing Candy Crush and bridge on their respective, you know, tablets and devices.
Yeah.
But it's great. Like, I still see them every couple weeks or so. And like, we do family get togethers. And yeah, that mixture of culture and language and sort of heritage and how I play into that and how my dad and then my aunts and uncles who have been brought into the family through marriage, who are also like not Indian as well. Like, it's an interesting kind of homogenous thing as well, and representative perhaps of kind of a larger social thing. So for me, like, that idea of the kind of multicultural effect was like, yeah, I see that like every day.
That's just like something you
that's live. Just like, I've been like, that's not a question. Like, that's how things are. So that perhaps has influenced kind of my understanding of a lot of things too.
Yeah. Cool. Eli,
Teed is a Discorder writer. He also plays in the band Jericho. Jericho have a release coming up soon. Is that right?
That is the hope. It's been a long time coming. We're hoping to put out an EP by the end of the month, by the end of January, and there should be a music video coming out with that, if not a little earlier as well.
Great. Keep an eye out for that, and I'll try to post it through the show page too. Eli, thanks so much, dude. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I need somebody, help. Not just anybody, help. You know, I need someone,
help. Do you ever feel uncomfortable or unsafe walking around campus at night? There's an AMS service dedicated to helping anyone trying to get across campus alone at night. We're SafeWalk, and we have your back. Call us at 604-822-5355 to request a transfer, or check out our website at ams.ubc.ca/safewalk for more information on hours and policies.
Hello, this is Textbook CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia, traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Coast Salish people. My name is Josh. I'm here with a very special guest today. Can you please introduce yourself?
My name is Sonia.
This is Textbook. This is a show about stories and academia and all student groups, all that junk. And this is the final segment of the show in a 3-segment show. This segment is called Tell Me About Your Paper. It's about academics. And Sonia is here to talk about some research she's doing. And she's going to tell us a little bit about that. First off, what are you studying?
I am in gender studies and poli-sci, but that one we don't talk about.
We don't like to talk about that one. So tell me about your paper. What were you writing on?
Well, I came here to tell you about actually this research I've done for a couple of years now, but I recently got to do a full paper on it, and it was on disco music and disco culture and disco spaces in the late 70s in New York, all of East Coast of the U.S. really, but New York in particular.
Good time to be dancing, maybe.
Yeah.
I get the sense that disco is having a bit of a comeback and that there are some stakes here.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, I mean, you probably know. It's all over. Whenever you go out, it's there. Thank Christ. Because it's fun.
It's fun.
And people don't really have fun anymore.
Yeah.
No, that's not true. That's not true. But, you know, it's just this total loss of control that comes with disco. That's really awesome, and I'm generally very glad that it's there on our dance floors here.
It's definitely on our dance floors here. I think it's hugely influential for house music and for all kinds of stuff that are coming out now. How did you kind of get to this research topic? What drew you to it, other than dancing to the music?
There's so many things, and I kept thinking about all of them. This is fate, I think.
Is it?
Yeah. I was thinking on the way here, I was thinking about how my first show that I've ever gone to with my parents at, I think, 7, was Boney M, who were a prominent disco band. And somehow they found their way to my tiny Russian town, and they performed in this big hockey arena that had just been built. And my dad, who, grew up in all this stuff, was like, yeah, Boney M. And I'm like, okay. I've never seen people of color in my life, but cool. And I remember being totally mind-blown. It was so over the top, and I thought tacky. And, completely just nuts, which it is. It totally is. It's just that there's beauty in it. And in Russian pop music in general is very much informed by those musical beginnings. Growing up in the 90s, Russian music was very, very much 4x4, women with weird hair kind of kind of thing. Just because Russia's late with everything.
And this show you went to when you were 7, what was that like? What was the crowd like? Where was it?
It was, from what I can remember, people were sitting down But people were really familiar with the songs. It's kind of bizarre, the selection that claws its way into Russia. But it was really, people were loving it. I remember that. I highly doubt that all the Russians in the audience knew about the beginnings of disco as a genre and a culture. But they were loving it anyway,
they came down to the hockey rink in any case.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about those origins of the genre. What, you know, as a JRSJ student, what were the significances and the meanings of it that really made you want to take it up as a research topic?
Yeah, well, disco is first and foremost a gay and black genre. It always was. It grew out of like funk and soul, and it kind of blended in with this general mindset of the 60s and the 70s of just this kind of fun, restless, earnest attitude, like a complete lack of irony, you know, in the kind of fun you're having. So the first disco spaces, like the first clubs, that were mostly just like people's houses and stuff and people's lofts. Yeah, they were just like a bunch of like gay, black, and Latinx dudes just like dancing away, like just in the dark with no real equipment and like no restrictions really. It's just totally DIY in that sense too. It's a very grassroots genre in that sense, and it's just fun, and it's also very gendered and, you know, yeah.
Really, like, I guess, like, underground is the thing.
No, it really was, which is kind of bizarre considering how much of an influence it was in the end. Like, disco really, as a culture, was prominent for, like, 4 or 5 years. Like, really, truly. Like, 75 to 79, maybe, like, 80. But the influence that it's had is...
In popular forms, right?
Yeah, yeah. Which is kind of cool. I'm actually looking into like what it became in other cultures too. I know there's like this really long tradition of like Indian disco and like Bollywood films and stuff,
cool.
Which I think is really cool. I kind of want to like,
yeah, that is really cool.
Research that more. Yeah.
And then there's also kind of this convergence with the AIDS crisis in some senses.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Like that's why I think it's important. That's why I think it's. That's why really I decided to research this, because I truly believe there's huge implications for, you know, whitewashing and kind of moralizing a genre like this. Disco, like when Reagan's New Right kind of emerged, one of its kind of pop culture oriented like agendas was, you know, presenting disco music and disco musicians as immoral, you know, like losers, like jobless scum.
Right.
And
this kind of AIDS rhetoric of
totally.
Hygiene and dirtiness,
yeah,
and lifestyle,
exactly.
Being a certain
exactly.
way.
Exactly.
Right?
And of course, disco was extremely gay and like it was in very racialized, and I do think that there is a strong connection between the erasure of AIDS as a disease and erasure of disco as a very political genre, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's the whole kind of politics of memory going on there.
Yeah.
A podcast that's come out recently that's been kind of big. I'm trying to remember the name of it now, and I was blanking on it, which is really embarrassing. But Disco Demolition Night being their first episode. I'm going to pull this up. I believe it's Undone, which is it's a new Gimlet series.
Okay.
But yeah, do you want to tell listeners a little bit about Disco Demolition
Night? Yeah, Disco Demolition, very interesting. So it's basically, it was an event. It was a promotion event for a major league game, I believe, in Chicago. I believe it was called the Comiskey Park, the arena. And it was this radio DJ, this dude named Steve Dahl, who was very anti-disco and who called for people to bring in disco records to the event And it basically culminated with like thousands and thousands of people like burning records and like blowing up like crates of records and stuff. And it was, I believe there's accounts of like disco DJs and musicians being attacked too. That was basically the beginning of the whole disco sucks thing. And that's believed to be the beginning of the downfall. And that's kind of what led to disco kind of making its way more underground. And that's kind of where you get house and like all that stuff.
Right. Because that kind of that kitschy thing and that whole, beginning of that rhetoric of, yeah, like it's cool to hate disco in a way.
Yeah. No, it was. I think it was an expression of this insecurity in many ways that had to do with the spatialization of disco in general. White cis hetero men were very publicly excluded from those spaces, and cis women to a degree. And I think it was an expression of like of a discomfort, really, like the whole disco backlash thing. It was rock fans too, largely, that kind of spearheaded that whole thing. And that's how you get like the whole like rock
versus disco thing.
Versus disco
which
thing,
is
yeah.
like a really racialized conflict
totally,
in the
it
first
totally
place,
is,
right?
Yeah. There's actually a disco label called Rock Sucks, which is kind of
like
kind of great. Yeah.
And then what is the, tell me more about these spaces themselves too. Like you're talking about
right.
how these spaces were really unique. What was it about them?
Well, just like as an aside, I think it's important. I, after reading so much about it, honestly feel like we don't understand it unless we've lived it in this particular case. So like, I wish I could tell you exactly how it was, really. But from what I can tell, it was very dramatic and gritty and grimy and fast paced. And, you know, and it was music, and it was dancing, it was bodies, and it was all kinds of bodies, and it was all in the dark. And a lot of kind of things I've read talk about like kind of this transcendence of the physical body and the physical form, and even race and gender, which still very much existed outside that vacuum of the discotheque. But inside, it was just like it was just darkness. It was just dancing. It was like the first appearance of gender-neutral bathrooms. It was kind of like, you know, I know there's like there were rivalries and there was a lot of drama and there were like fist fights in the DJ booth and like all this kinds of stuff. And I think that's also very important to remember.
That's part of the history
like,
too.
Yeah, it's nasty. And I think it's cool to know that. I think it's great to like humanize a culture that's kind of whitewashed now and
yeah.
presented in a very certain way.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah,
I really
no
appreciate
worries.
It.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to go off with the song. This is one you suggested. Do you want to introduce it a little
yeah,
bit?
Yeah, it's a track called You're in My Pocket by Rhianna Coleman.
Cool.
And it's great.
CITR Textbook 101.9 FM. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Sonia. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Till next time.
Yeah.